The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good Tuesday morning to you. Very welcome along to the programme on this, the 27th of January 2026. And as I was saying to Lee a little earlier on, for me anyway, Storm Chandra kind of came a little bit out of the blue. Certainly in this part of the world, I knew there was some sort of yellow wind warnings down the country, although it was extended to us. Maybe I'm just out of the loop on the weather. But anyway, it's not too bad out there, but there are trees down, and you have to be careful out there. There are trees down here, there, and everywhere, it would seem. So just be careful. I would imagine they were vulnerable after the last storm, and a few of the gusts this morning were enough just to tip them over at the edge. But it can catch you out, and quite a bit of water lying on the roads as well. Right, if there's anything, by the way, in that regard you need us to get out, 086 60 25 000, that's the WhatsApp and text number. That's the same number for you, of course, to comment throughout the course of this morning. You can give us a call as well on 074 91 25 000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Lots coming up on the show today, including a very popular item, Community Garda information. That's just after the 10 o'clock news, or not far off thereafter. Right, let's look at some of the papers this morning. We'll start with the Irish Times, and the Cabinet's expected to approve the abolition of the triple lock. This is a big issue for an awful lot of people, and you know, they will have their concerns as to what this means going forward. Well, the government is set to reject a recommendation from an Oireachtas committee to have a formal legal review before Irish troops are sent abroad on peacekeeping missions once the triple lock is abolished. Cabinet is this morning expected to approve plans to push ahead with the abolition of the triple lock, which requires UN approval before Irish troops are sent abroad on peacekeeping missions. The Defence Amendment Bill is likely to be brought before the Oireachtas in the coming month, where opposition parties have vowed to fight the measure with support from NGOs and campaigning groups outside Leinster House. The bill, introduced by the Minister for Defence, Helen McEntee, who's also Minister for Foreign Affairs, will provide for the removal of the so-called triple lock, which is triggered whenever more than 12 members of the Defence Forces are being deployed outside the state as part of an international force. It provides that no Irish missions can be deployed without being sanctioned by three bodies: the United Nations, the government, and the Dáil. So there's, I mean, a rough look at it, the pros and cons, or the fors and against the abolition of it. People believe that maybe the likes of Russia or other countries have a veto on Ireland being able to send troops where it sees fit. So that's one of the arguments for it. If there's a situation whereby we have Irish people in peril in a foreign country, and a crack team can be sent in to help recover them or take them home, the argument is that the removal of the triple lock would facilitate that more easily. Others obviously have concerns that range from anything into it is problematic on all levels, but others are concerned that it might pave the way for Ireland's participation in a European army. You know the arguments, they're quite extreme on both sides of the debate. I think we'll hear far more about it when it gets to the Dáil stage, and the opposition parties, the government parties, have their says in relation to that. But the Cabinet's expected to approve the abolition of the triple lock, and then it goes into the Dáil for further debate in the weeks ahead. And of course, it's something we'll keep you very much across, that debate, as it really gets going in earnest. I said a little earlier on in the month that inevitably the front pages are going to be talking about whether or not the Taoiseach should go meet Donald Trump for various reasons. Every year it's different reasons. This, you can pick any geopolitical situation and that's the reason not to go, or any decisions that can be made even on American soil, don't go. Taoiseach's going to go anyway. That's a fact, because the argument, whether you agree with it or not, is relatively sound. Far better to use the opportunity to continue the arrangement, use the opportunity to express views directly to the president, and also maintain that tradition for when inevitably Donald Trump isn't there. So those are the arguments for it. The arguments against, obviously, in that it would be a protest and it would send a message and so on and so forth. What I thought was interesting in this poll, as I say, that it's always going to go ahead no matter what happens. But what I think is interesting in this poll is it's a poll of people, the general public, and apparently almost half of you are opposed to the Taoiseach meeting with Trump for St. Patrick's Day. 47% of you, in fact. So I'll read on here. A clear majority of the public believe the Taoiseach should not visit the White House for St. Patrick's Day after the Greenland and Venezuela crises. An exclusive poll by Amarak Research carried out for the Irish Daily Mail has found almost half of the public, 47%, believe Micheál Martin should not travel to the Oval Office. The poll conducted between January 21st and 26th found 35% believe he should attend, 18% said they don't know. Those surveyed were asked to take into account Donald Trump's actions in Venezuela, where he abducted leader Nicolas Maduro, and Greenland, which he threatened to annex before backing down and, before he got everything he wanted and then backed down. So that's it. The majority of you, 47%, don't want Donald Trump to go, don't want Micheál Martin to go and see Donald Trump. There you go. Interesting. What did I expect? I didn't expect more of the public not to want him to go, to be honest with you. But anyway, apparently you're feeling better about life. Confidence levels among consumers edged up this month, but there is a warning that the improvements may only be temporary. This is the Irish Independent. The seasonal switch off from economic and financial news over the Christmas and New Year period, coupled with some New Year optimism that the turbulence of the past year may not be repeated, has buoyed consumers. However, confidence levels are down on what they were last month, or this month last year, according to the January Credit Union Consumer Sentiment Survey. So what this actually shows, right, we were talking, it's actually part of the podcast. We were having a conversation in the podcast and I was talking about how, you know, the difference between now and previously, we're very fearful. But we're very fearful because everywhere we go, we're being told how bad things are or how bad things might get. And listen, I suppose I could say we play our part in that as well, right? Because covering current affairs, it can come across like that. But as soon as people switch off from the news, so the economic and financial news over Christmas, they feel better about life. They feel more optimistic about the year ahead. So it just goes to show, you know, this constant, you know, things are bad, things are dangerous, everything's bad. It does affect us and it affects our spending. And when we take even just a short break, we look forward to the year, we're all optimistic. So do we need to take a choice to sort of switch out of that stuff? I have said before, I believe that this show keeps up to date with everything, right? And maybe give news in the evening a bit of a break. Give the TV news a bit of a break. Going to bed with the 9 o'clock news ringing in your ears. Is it good for you? I don't know. We try to not be too not catastrophic. What's the phrase I'm looking for? Anyway, it'll come to me. Right, I'm just mentioning this. I haven't an obsession with Elon Musk, but yesterday Donegal County Council did vote, in fact, as far as I'm aware, did vote, in fact, to come off the X platform in protest at the nudification of images. They're not made fully nude, they're put into bikinis, etc. We chatted yesterday to Councillor Micheál Colum. He was proposing the motion, and councillors backed that motion. So the councillors have said to the executive, effectively, it's our democratic view that not only does the Donegal County Council come off the X platform, but it also announces that it is coming off it. So that was passed. Now, I mean, obviously, a motion is a motion. The executive will have to decide what the right thing to do is. They have the ultimate decision in relation to that, don't they? There is a few things to consider, I would say, if you don't mind me saying, in that, you know, there are people on Twitter, there's quite a lot of people on Twitter, and there is a responsibility for a local authority to be where people are. It doesn't mean you're endorsing the owner of the platform. It doesn't mean you're endorsing the content of the platform, but that's where people are, and it's a way to reach those people. It's also one of the most timely ways to deliver news and information. This road is closed. Here's the telephone numbers. There, the power's out there. This is what you should do. It's a means of getting in touch with the people. But also, a third string to that, and there are more strings, it's also a place whereby Donegal County Council can be held to account, right? So if people are upset with the council about certain moves or what have you, they can tag in the council and say, look, I don't think this is right. I wish you would do this. So in other words, it's a point of accountability. And there are other reasons. Bogus accounts as well, right? So if you come off a platform completely, someone can create a Donegal County Council handle and spread out disinformation, and you don't have a position on that platform to counter that disinformation or misinformation. So, you know, it's a big decision to come off a social media platform in protest at certain elements of it, a fraction of it, if the truth be told. But the councillors want the council off X, and it'll be up to the council whether or not they come off X now. What do you think? Do you want to talk about that a bit more, or are you sick and tired of it? But the reason I brought that up is A, to give you an update on that motion, because we talked about it yesterday, but also B, to talk about comments from Maria Walsh. Maria Walsh is very active on X. But she wants Elon Musk's AI app, Grok, which allowed users to create deepfake sexual images, to be immediately suspended. It was announced yesterday that the European Commission has launched a probe into the tool. Global pressure has been mounting on Musk after sexually explicit... Sexually explicit fake AI images have been shared of adults and children. So they've been put into compromised positions or reduced to underwear. EU Commissioner for Tech Sovereignty, Henna Verdunen, beg your pardon, said the inquiry will determine if X has met its legal obligation or whether it treated rights of European citizens, including those of women and children, as collateral damage. Now, it stopped the ability to do that. So the horse has bolted at this stage. But anyway, what do you think? I heard Lee mention it. I'll just reiterate it because people listen to the radio at different times of the day. Fair play to Centra. They flogged almost 10 million chicken fillet rolls last year. That's a lot of chicken from one place, isn't it? The retailer revealed the enormous demand for the lunch favourite helped push sales up 4.6% to a record 2.2 billion last year. It yesterday reported bumper growth across deli, coffee and ice cream during 2025. And Centra chiefs told how its deli section delivered growth of 7.4% across last year. 10 million chicken fillets sold. And just a wee heads up for you, it's not covered extensively, but in case you are using Aptamil baby milk, batches of Aptamil infant formula are being recalled in Ireland, despite earlier assurances that the product had not been distributed in the country. The affected product and batch is 800 gram packs of Aptamil 1 from birth, first infant milk, with an expiry date of October 31st, 2006. It's probably unlikely any of you have that in your house, but I thought I would mention it rather than not. So it's just been recalled, just in case you did pick some up across the border or in a local shop. Now, road users are advised that there is flooding at the junction between Watery Road, that's the L1841, and the R238 regional road at Burnfoot Village. It is passable with care, but as soon as you're going into water, it's on your own head be it, right? There are low cables blown out onto the road at Castle Shanahan School on the Letterkenny to Remelton Road. Lorries will need to be careful. Again, it's not to be preachy, but just to offer advice that there is quite a bit of disruption with the wind in terms of branches out on roads, trees out on roads, water lying on the roads as well. So no need to stay at home per se. But if you have to go out or if you're going out, just exercise a wee bit of caution because you don't know what's around the corner. Right, now, Tom Murray is the president of the Irish Pharmacy Union and owner of Murray Pharmacies, and he joins me on the show now. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, pharmacies across the Northwest are being urged to sign up for the Common Conditions Services. What is the Common Conditions Services or service?
Yeah, I'm delighted to say, Greg, it's part of what was agreed at the pharmacy agreement with the government and the Department of Health in August last year, and over 94% of pharmacies have signed up to offer the service. So basically, it's 8 common clinical conditions whereby the Department of Health, the government and the minister recognising the excellence of the pharmacist, the accessibility of the pharmacist and the urgency of need of care for patients to come into pharmacies to where they'll be able to be prescribed prescription strength medicines by their pharmacist for the likes of impetigo, shingles, conjunctivitis, uncomplicated urinary tract infections, thrush and allergic rhinitis. And those are all common conditions where the earlier the treatment is received, the better. the idea is that it removes some of the pressure from those people attending GPs or indeed attending A&E, as some of them do if they feel they can't get a GP appointment, and to increase accessibility of patients to appropriate care in their local pharmacy, so, whilst recognising the upskilling of pharmacists.
Firstly, this is not then a service available at all pharmacies. How do we know if it is or isn't? Is it the majority? Is it the minority? Well, what's the story?
Well, over 94% have signed up, so it's almost every single pharmacy in the country. There's only 6% in the country that haven't signed up. They are available to find on the HSE service finder, the website. On the HSE website, you can actually Google common conditions and you can find a list of all the pharmacies that are offering the service. But with over 94% of them signed up, you would say that there is categorically that there's geographical coverage across the country, because over 95% of people live within 5 kilometres of a pharmacy. So if the massive majority of pharmacies have signed up, then there's nobody who's denied that service geographically.
Okay, and in terms of cost, is this a free service? So if I present with a cold sore, for an example, is the diagnosis and the writing of a prescription charged, and does that charge extend to those with a medical card?
Unfortunately, yes, the service is currently private only. That's the way it was designed by the stakeholders involved. The medicine that is the outcome, if a prescription is prescribed, may well be covered by the medical card or by the drug payment scheme card if people have either of those two eligibility cards. But the service itself currently is private. And there is a charge for the service.
Is it a fixed charge, or does it depend on each pharmacy what they charge?
Well, it's dependent on each pharmacy. Unfortunately, competition law prevents me suggesting a charge, but it is dependent on each pharmacy. But all pharmacies since the 1st of January now display a list of prices in all their pharmacies, so it's very easy for anybody to look in the pharmacy or just contact the pharmacy and ask them what price they charge for the prescribing, for the appointment, because it's a consultation base. It takes 10 to 15 minutes, so it is a full, formal, structured consultation, which may or may not result in the writing of a prescription. And then you have the option to get that prescription dispensed in that pharmacy, or if you want to, you can take it to another pharmacy to get the medicine supplied there.
Is there also a charge? Is there a charge if the pharmacist doesn't believe a prescription is required, or if it's outside the scope of the common condition service? Do we know if there would be a charge even if it didn't result in a prescription?
If it's outside the scope, then I would imagine the pharmacist wouldn't go ahead with the consultation and the consultation was cancelled. But like any other medical consultation, the fee is for the consultation, so there will be a charge for the consultation. And it may be that the appropriate advice is that you don't need a prescription medicine, because some of the stuff that we'll be prescribing are antibiotics, and if it's not appropriate to prescribe an antibiotic, then it's not appropriate to prescribe them. And maybe some of the advice is just counselling and advice to the patient, like you would get at any other medical consultation.
You talked about how some medicines might be covered by the medical card. On the spot, or would that be something the customer would have to recoup?
No, it would be covered on the spot. So, for example, Fusidin cream for impetigo is covered on the medical card, and if I was to write a prescription for you for impetigo today and then supply that medicine to you and you had a medical card, I would supply the medicine through the medical card scheme.
Yeah, this doesn't feel like what we've talked about in the past, in that the idea that maybe people on lower incomes might not be able to avail of this service. It feels like we're moving more to a two-tier rather than a system that makes it more accessible for all. Do you see it as that, and do you hope that maybe medical card patients, this could be extended to allow them access this service as they would a GP service?
Well, my personal anticipation would be yes, that's what it should be. I think we have argued always and agreed that healthcare shouldn't be dependent on somebody's ability to pay. As it currently is established, the service is private service established by the Department of Health. So, unfortunately, I don't have the influence on that. But I would like to see it extended as the service grows and as more and more people use, and as the Department of Health grows confidence in the data that they see from the prescribing of pharmacists, as it does in other jurisdictions. We're not unique in doing this. It does happen in the north of Ireland through the minor ailments system, and it does happen in Australia and Canada and various other international countries that I would use as comparators. So I would hope eventually that it will extend to be free at the point of care, but it is a private service only at the moment.
Can the farmers do the initial diagnosis of these eight common conditions, or would they have to have been diagnosed by a GP previously?
No, the consultation is such that the pharmacist does the diagnosis and prescribing.
Okay, and if you put me on a course of antibiotics, how does the doctor know I've been on that course of antibiotics? Is there a communication
there? Well, it can be with the consent of the patient, whereas the pharmacist can provide that information to the doctor with the patient's consent. There's no obligation to do so, but we can do it. In most cases, I would advise that you do for continuity of care.
And if there's no age limit on this, is there? If a parent brought a 12-year-old in with one of these conditions, the pharmacy can have...
Some of the conditions do have, in the protocols of the conditions, there are age restrictions or even gender restrictions. So, for example, for the uncomplicated urinary tract infections, males don't tend to have uncomplicated urinary tract infections, so they would be excluded. There are age cohorts for each of the conditions, and they're specific to each condition.
Okay, right. And it's not easy to rhyme them off now. I'd need to check that out myself, would I?
Well, the easiest thing to do, but there are eight different conditions and there's long protocols for each one.
Understood.
So
okay.
It would take...
Yeah, no problem. No, I'm not. I don't question your ability to do it. It's the practicality of doing it. Tom, listen, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
No bother.
All right. Tom Murray, president of the Irish Pharmacy Union and owner of Murray Pharmacies. He's speaking on behalf of the Irish Pharmacy Union. He's expressed his desire. I just wonder why we've introduced something that is not covered by sort of medical card, you know, so that people can have the same experience completely there as they might with a GP. But anyway, now we are joined on the programme by Jim Fury, Assistant General Secretary of the Mandate Trade Union Ireland. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme today.
And Greg.
Right, now, up to 70% of retail workers have personally experienced abuse, language or behaviour from customers while working, according to new research. Tease us through this, because it's horrible to hear.
It's kind of in line with a survey that we had done late last year ourselves, so the figures are fairly accurate, I would say, and it's certainly a daily occurrence. Our members face kind of choice language, to say the least, and then that escalates then into some racist, misogynistic, and even threats of violence. And that's a daily occurrence, sadly, and we're seeing that right throughout the country.
The whole idea of this is to have the conversation out in public. In other words, people working in retail will know fine well this is ongoing. If it's not they, it might be a work colleague or what have you. And I suppose, is it to challenge the public to think about the reality on the ground?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case, Greg. Really and truly what we're asking is for the public to call it out. For some reason or another, people seem to think, and it is a minority, but I would say it's probably close to 1 in 10 misbehave in this way. But we need the public to call it out. You know, you don't see it in other situations. You don't see it at the cinema. You don't see it in restaurants very often. But for some reason or another, within the stores, it seems to be commonplace.
Why do you think that is? We're sort of maybe veering into the opinion side of things, but why would we see it more in retail than you might say, for instance, in hospitality or the cinema? Or
I'm not quite sure, but for some reason or another, a certain cohort of people seem to believe that it's okay just to take their anger out on the retail worker. And we see certain peaks and troughs very early in the morning, and then usually from around 4 p.m. up to 6 p.m. In certain situations, some of it gangs young kids, but in other situations, mature adults who should know better. And really and truly, just because the item isn't there or the refund policy is not something that they're happy with, they seem to think that the people behind the counter are the people that they can just hurl abuse at.
And maybe, and this is in no way to justify it, they just pick whatever they choose to pick to abuse people, right? So, in other words, what I'm trying to get at, it might not necessarily be that they're saying what they're saying because of someone's ethnicity or their gender or whatever it might be. Is it because of a respect thing, if you know what I mean? Do you think there's a lack of respect, and those that disrespect will find any excuse to offend someone? If because, you know, they could do the same in a pub or restaurant, where maybe they're afraid of not getting access to a pub or restaurant. Maybe that's what it's down to. But do you think it's just that the grafters in retail don't get the respect that they deserve?
I think it's both those points. I think the fact that if they behave like that in a restaurant or a public house, they would be barred. And sadly, what's happening is the retailers don't turn them away. They should be refused entry into the stores in the future. But also, I think people have forgotten very quickly that it was the retail workers that kept us all with food on the table during COVID. There seemed to be a level of respect then. They were called frontline workers then. That was soon forgotten by the government and by the general public, it seems, also. And people don't seem to show the same level of respect to retail workers that they do to other workers in our society. And it's something that we just can't comprehend, and we're not willing to stand for anymore. We're calling out the public now to say, look, you need to challenge people when they're misbehaving, when they're standing beside you in the store, or at least go to the store manager and say, look, I've witnessed this in your store and it's not acceptable.
Foul language, verbal abuse is bad enough, but a quarter, in fact, over a quarter of those affected have also experienced violent, aggressive or threatening behaviour too, which is, you know, it's another level of abuse.
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more commonplace, and it's something that I suppose there's a tradition in retail of families working within the retail. And what we're seeing now is, because it's so frequent and because it's so frightening, a lot of the current workers are advising their family members not to go into the retail sector. And really, it's something that needs to be addressed, because it's very scary when someone threatens you and they say, I'll see you outside when you're finished your shift.
Horrible.
And you have to go and walk to the bus stop or the Lewis stop in some cases. It's terrifying for those people.
No, and I have a little bit of an insight into this from a brief time I worked in England. You can get very paranoid because you don't know whether those threats are real or not, and you can't just simply brush them off because they've been said and they're on the record. There's targeted abuse as well. Foul language, as I mentioned, verbal abuse. A lot of the abuse is based on a person's race or their gender as well?
Yeah. And what we see is that it's an easy target. You know, the racial slurs are hurled at people. What we're seeing is, and retail is predominantly female-populated, some of the misogynistic comments that are made to our members. And really and truly, it's becoming such a piece that workers are nearly expecting that within their working week they're going to experience it at some time, and that's totally unacceptable.
Right. So, I mean, as a union, you can only do so much, right? We have this report. For a lot of people working in retail and their families, this is no news to them, because obviously you take this stuff home with you, right? What can happen next? Do we need to look at, you know, a barring system or something? Because I think that is part of the issue with cinemas, restaurants, bars. In other words, if you misbehave, you lose access. Whereas, you know, that you don't see that in retail. So I don't know what the reason is, but that would be my chief suspect.
Absolutely. For us, we believe, you know, if you come in, you're abusive in a situation, you should never be able to enter that store again. It's simple. If you think back to before the large multinational stores, if you had a corner store and you misbehave, the local owner wouldn't let you back inside the door again. And that needs to be the place. They need to know that there is a consequence to that bad behaviour.
Right. OK. Listen, Jim, thanks very much indeed. It's horrible that people have to experience life like that whilst they're working. But unfortunately, if you're in retail, the likelihood is that you have personal experience of abusive language or behaviour, and you've either been the victim of it or you've witnessed it. I would say you're up to close to the max at that point.
Yeah. And look, just one last thing, Greg. There is a bill, the Protection of Retail Workers Bill, Senator Mary Fitzpatrick has put forward. It needs to be placed into law as soon as possible.
Rightio. Listen, thank you very much for your time. 086 60 25,000. Maybe you work in retail. You can give us some further insight into that. It's a funny old situation, you know, the way the world is, in that if you go into shops, you are on a daily basis interacting with hardworking people of all different sexes, of all different racial backgrounds, you know, and you just get on with it. You engage with people all the while, but as soon as you sort of post a picture of someone of colour or something people don't like, all of a sudden it seems to be okay to criticise those people literally based on their ethnicity. It's like two-track things. So in everyday life, you know, we're getting on with things, and people are work colleagues and all that type of stuff. And yet in this online space, anything goes. You can simply say absolutely anything, it would seem. Right. Is there an age limit on a person receiving this treatment? My daughter is 12 and has one of these conditions. It's condition specific is the best answer I can give you there. If I have a medical card, will this be accepted as a form of payment to the pharmacist, or is this another service I'll have to pay for if I can't get an appointment for the GP? Unfortunately, it's the latter. At the moment, it's a private only service. The only maybe saving grace is that the medicine might qualify as free on your medical card. I don't like it. I don't know why we've, why not? I'd almost prefer if we wait and have a system that has equal access to all. Doesn't, you don't have to be, you know, somewhat well off. Do I need a GP diagnosis for the condition from a GP before the pharmacist will treat me? No, eight of them is the. It covers eight conditions. How much is this service in the pharmacy? I can't give you that figure because it varies from pharmacy to pharmacy. And there's more coming in relation to that and the abuse of shop workers. Now we are joined in studio by Martin McGinley. Martin, thank you so much for calling in. Great to see you. How are you keeping?
Keeping the best, yeah.
All right, flat out.
Hammering away.
you've got your third arm with you, which is always a... always a treat. Yeah. We're going to hear some music from you. But first, I want to talk about the event that's coming up. It's Traveller Tunes, is that correct? And part of Letterkenny Tradweek, is it?
Yeah, part of Tradweek.
Let's talk about the Tradweek firstly, sort of as a whole. It's a fantastic event, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great start of the year and puts the, I suppose, the regional cultural centre and the theatre and the spotlight in the trad world and gets people out after Christmas and that. And there's a very good lineup this week or this year for Trad Week. I got involved with we're having a launch of a short series of podcasts I did for the Donegal Travellers Project, and they're called Travellers Talking. And so I thought we might build that in, because the Travellers are very much associated with the traditional music in Donegal, particularly the Doherty clan. So I thought we'd create three events on Saturday in the RCC, starting with Rab Cherry talking about his research into the Dohertys, John Doherty, Mickey Doherty, all those famous fiddlers. Then have the podcast launched by Senator Eileen Flynn, and then a big concert then with Raid Mooney from Alton, with Kevin Doherty, Four Men and a Dog, Roisin Harrigan, Roisin McGrory, Paul Harrigan, Seamus Gibson, myself, and Dr. Connor Caldwell, and then Bianca Rolliter, who'd be a granddaughter of a fiddle player called Simon Doherty, who lived outside Fintown. So that a chat with Jeremy sort of set that all up, and that's going to be a great day on Saturday with the concert happening at 2 o'clock. But there's lots of other stuff. I was talking to Dermot Byrne there at the weekend, and he was coming down to play. That was going to be a great gig. I couldn't make it that night, but next Tuesday night I'll be in the theatre because Seamus Gibson, who lives here in Letterkenny, a fantastic fiddle player. He's going to be playing with a piano player called So Young Yoon, and also a cellist.
Wow.
And then Nava going to be playing after that on Tuesday. So there's lots of stuff happening.
Yeah. Is Letterkenny Trad Week accessible, right, for the broader sort of community outside the trad community?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And I ask that question with a view to encouraging more people to know that it is, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you've got the whole gamut. I mean, take, for example, the concert on Saturday. There's going to be, there'll be tunes at it. That's on Saturday, 2 o'clock, the Travellers tunes. There'll be tunes at it, but there'll also be songs from Mairead Mooney and Kevin Doherty, two of the best singers in the country, probably. We're going to have a poem there. Frank Galligan has written a poem for Stephen McCall from Ardra, who died so tragically. We'll have that. And the poem was mentioned, a set of reels called McCall's Reels, and we'll be playing those. We'll also have a poem that Kevin has just finished a PhD, Kevin Doherty, on the on aspects of the poetry of Seamus Heaney. So he'll be reading a poem. So you've got a sort of a, it's just not non-stop music in that event, for example. Then you have the Henry Girls who are launching an album. You've got Nava who are, you know, sort of got music from the sort of Middle East, also music from Ireland. So it's kind of a broad spectrum.
It's astonishing when you sort of go through some of the highlights. What an amazing lineup, isn't it?
Can you imagine
if you were trying to organise this in a different part of the county? You're just able to pull these fantastic, not just amazing local names, but international names out of the air. Well, the Henry Girls, Mairead, and so many more as well. And Saturday's come together really quite nice with tying in with the podcast then, the poetry. And what have you in the
it's great that Rab can come along because Rab Cherry has been very involved with the Donegal Fiddlers Association called Carriages and the Fiddlery, but he's been researching the Doherty family, John Doherty, Mickey Doherty, those famous fiddle players, for the last 15-20 years. So he's going to be talking. It's coming to an end now.
Right.
He probably will continue, but
I know what you're on about. There's some point whereby you say right, yeah, I'm the back broke of it.
He's got a family tree now with 93 names on it. Brilliant. And they're all basically associated. It's the people who are associated with the music. So he's done a massive amount of research. So I hope there'll be a few people along to that at 11. And then 1 o'clock is the podcast launch. I went out and talked to travellers right around the county.
What was that like? Did you enjoy that? I imagine you would. Anytime you're having a conversation, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an eye-opener because you don't get a chance to really sit down and, you know, to talk to people from that community very often. So I was right round from Ballyshannon to Ballantra to Letterkenny to Remelton, talking about different aspects. There's three podcasts, and the first one is about being on the road. And I suppose the message from that one I got was that basically travellers are kind of moving off the road now.
Which is kind of interesting within the travelling community itself. It's an interesting and important talking point as well, because that is tradition.
Yeah, that's
and it's a tradition.
Hugh Freel said he works with the Donegal Travellers Project here in the town, and he said, you know, we were the nomads of Irish society, but now we're basically there's nowhere to pull in, and most travellers now are sort of they're living in houses, and there's a very positive aspects to that, in that traveller children, for example, are getting much better chance at having an education and stuff.
I mean, obviously, I recognise there's two sides to every story, but I'm of an age where I remember travellers being chased from pillar to post. You know what I mean? And there comes a point whereby there's nowhere left to go. The blocks are there. The trees are there.
You
know.
Yeah.
But I mean, things do move on. And of course, you know, modern life moved on as well, maybe. And it's more difficult to accommodate a community with a nomadic lifestyle. I don't know. There's a lot to it, right? But I'm of an age where I remember that I've lived through the transition almost.
Yeah, but talking to somebody like Aki McGinley, who lives in Remelton, you know, he says he's been living in houses for more than 40 years. And I said, you know, would you go back on the road? He said, I'll go back in a heartbeat, except the road isn't the same as it was when I knew it. Back when you get pulled in to places like the Cup and Saucer outside Remelton, there'd be a load of other families there. They'd be singing and having the crack around the campfire. You know, he sort of painted a picture of, you know, a community of people on the road having the crack. And, you know, he said he'd go back to it, but it's not there. The opportunities aren't there. Those halting places are, like, there's another halting place is where the bridge comes in outside Carrigart. That's totally changed as well. That used to be a great place for travelling for parties.
Ballantra is there was a traditional place there, and then it became sort of enclosed, and I'm not sure if it's heavily populated now, but they're all over the place. Right, I want to get a bit of music from you, Martin, before we run out of time. Stormy weather, was this, I mean, where did you pull this one?
I was just hearing the wind
talk about being on
point.
Penrith Milton.
Current affairs fiddling.
Well, you see, John Doherty is probably the most famous of the Dohertys, and he basically had a tune for every occasion and a story. So the first thing I heard last night was, as the wind started to gather up at the High Cairn in Milton, was John Doherty saying, I'm going to play, you know, one now called Stormy Weather. And I was thinking, well, that's a pretty good choice.
Good. Well,
let's
have a listen, and then we can remind people of what's coming up on Saturday. This is Martin McGinley, organiser of Traveller Tunes, which is part of Letterkenny Trad Week, and this is Stormy Weather.
Stormy Weather.
Stuff. Do you have to do any warm-up exercises for your hands, particularly in the morning, I wonder?
Well, I'd say you're supposed to. And I was doing the work. I did a workshop at the winter school in Gidore there. And it's something you have to be aware of, because people are coming into this workshop and they might be playing for 3 hours or 5 hours. Yeah. And they're not used to it. So they're better to start. And we just happen to have somebody in the class who's an expert in that whole thing about warming up and relaxing. So, yeah, you're supposed to do...
I would imagine so, because the complexity of the movements. Martin McGinley is here to talk about the Traveller Tunes event. It's a high-profile traditional music concert, Traveller's Tunes. It's taking place at the Regional Cultural Centre, Letterkenny, on Saturday at 2 p.m. And it is part of that wider Trad Week, Letterkenny Trad Week. And the event celebrates the significant contribution of travellers to Donegal and Irish traditional music, with a particular focus on the Doherty family tradition. The lineup includes Rainey Mooney, Alton, Kevin Doherty, fiddlers Rashi McGrory, Bianca Roleder, Connor Caldwell, and Martin McGinley himself, and percussionist Robbie Fotrell will be there as well. And the concert is promising an intimate, informal setting combined with tunes, songs, storytelling, poetry, as you mentioned. Tickets are just €10 and are available from the RCC. Where would you get value like that? And, space is not infinite either, too.
No.
So I think it's going to be a good one. What time do things kick off? You said the concert's at 2, I believe.
Yeah, well, the Rabs talk is at 11, so we'll have tea and coffee and we'll play a few tunes before that. And he'll be playing a lot of music clips from the various Dohertys. You had the famous John Doherty and his brother Mickey, whose reputation is growing. There was just a double or triple album that they released of his playing, recorded at his home in Stranraer shortly before he died in 1970. You have a guy out in Australia called Mick Doherty, who, if anybody's interested in hearing about Donegal back when he was growing up, probably in the 40s or 50s, he's done a big interview. It's online with, if you put in Mick Doherty Australia, it'll probably come up. But it's really interesting hearing about that. The county at that level from somebody who left. And Simon Doherty, the list goes on, one musician after another.
Family Tree, 94, 96, did you say?
What's that?
The Family Tree.
Family Tree, 93 different names on it. So he's done a massive amount of work. That's at 11 o'clock. And then at 1 o'clock, there's the podcast launch. Senator Eileen Flynn is doing that. And David Freel, who lectures in the ATU, he's chairing. So that podcast project was sort of the brainchild of Siobhan McLaughlin and the team at the Donegal Travellers Project. And, you know, people should, I think, know more about travellers because, you know, they have, it's a really, they're interesting people and they have interesting stories to tell.
More than an opportunity to have a sampler on Saturday.
Yeah, and then the podcasts are going up on Apple Podcasts as well. Brilliant. Three podcasts, so that'll be, and then the concert at 2:00. So it's going to be a bit hectic because there's other things happening on Saturday as well. For example, like 6:00, I think Declan Doherty's exhibition is opening, officially opening at the RCC. And then that night at the Greenan, we'll be remembering one of our great musicians, Ted Ponsonby.
Yes.
So I'll be playing with, and Sarah's, his daughter's, putting a wee band together for that. So we'll be playing at that. So it's just a matter of keeping your ears and eyes open about what's on, because there'll be something to suit everybody.
All right, Martin, listen, thank you so much for calling up. I really, really do appreciate it. And we'll link, well, you can go to the regionalculturalcentre.com, actually, and all the info's there. Martin McGinley, thank you so very much indeed.
Where your opinion matters. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Now, a lot of you taking an interest in matters in the United States, and you would know that in January, federal agents from ICE and Border Patrol fatally shot two US citizens, Rennie Good and Alex Pretty, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in separate incidents during immigration enforcement operations. Now, a top US immigration official is expected now to leave the US city of Minneapolis in what may mark a shift in the White House's tone after the fatal shooting of that second US citizen by federal officers over the weekend. Larry Donnelly is a Boston attorney, a University of Galway lecturer, and a political columnist, and he joins me on the programme now. Larry, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
There's been quite a shift, hasn't there, in the last day or two? But just going and starting first with the shooting of Alex Pretty, what we did see in the first instance was the usual rhetoric from very high sources, even up as far as the White House: domestic terrorism, he was intent on taking lives. And very quickly that was rolled back on, seemingly, to the point where we're at now. Maybe I've misframed that. Why is it different in the context of Alex Pretty's death compared to, say, Rennie Good's?
I think that it was patently false, is the bottom line. I think that anybody who saw the video saw an individual who was brandishing nothing but a phone. He wasn't behind the wheel of a car, yet he was on the ground and he was effectively slaughtered by a number of ICE enforcement agencies with a number of gunshots. There's absolutely no disputing in this instance what happened. It was an extrajudicial killing on the streets of Philadelphia, on the streets of Minneapolis, by masked men.
ICE are engaged in an operation, and if you listen to the White House, to remove very dangerous people that shouldn't be in the United States. A, do you buy that? And B, if that is the case, you know, removing people that aren't very nice people, why would there be any resistance to that?
Well, I think that might have been the mission statement of ICE. I think that that's why Donald Trump convinced the American people that this was something that had to happen, that they needed to go out and apprehend violent criminals and felons. And I think were that to be with the actual remit of ICE, then I think you'd see pretty broad support for ICE, because Americans, just like most other people, have enough problems with their own homegrown criminals. Why would they want to have people in the country illegally who are committing crimes? Had that been the case, then again, I think ICE would enjoy wide public support. But it is manifestly not the case. The case here is that they are going through the cities and towns of the United States wearing masks, and apprehending people and terrorizing people around the United States. It is really an appalling vista. And you talk about the Trump administration seeming about face on all of this. I think that that's no mistake. I think it is in reaction to, first of all, opinion polling, which is against the tactics of ICE. And also, I think the president is starting to hear from members of his own party who face midterm elections next year that this is disastrous for them.
Yeah, and of course the people who are engaged in this activity aren't trained to operate in urban environments, and this is in no way to excuse what they have done. It's more to question the administration. They work presumably normally in rural areas, in borders, in border regions. No protests. You know, they should never have been there. They're not equipped to be there. They're not trained to be there.
Yeah, and I'm afraid it goes worse than that, Greg. I think not only are they not trained for urban warfare, as it were, or urban policing, arguably they're not trained adequately for anything with respect to law enforcement. We know now that in a rush to get these people on the streets, the trainings were truncated greatly, so much that it was a matter of weeks, for instance, for some of them. And the other thing that I think is worrisome here is, if you look at least some instances, I am not by any stretch saying that this is all instances or even a majority of instances, but if you look at in some instances, ICE agents have quite nefarious political backgrounds and connections that arguably has fueled them to join ICE, but because they see themselves as fulfilling some sort of personal mandate to rid the country of so-called illegal aliens. So it's really worrying.
Indeed. We wouldn't be here politically, would we, if the video evidence wasn't so conclusive?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, I think, look, in my own view, I think that the evidence around Rene Good was quite conclusive. There are, however, differing interpretations of that. I think that speaks to the fact that a lot of Americans are blinded by their political ideology. But whatever about that for one side, there is no disputing what happened here. And I think that that's why President Trump, and indeed now we see he's relieving the guy who was, effectively relieving the guy who was in command in Minneapolis to be replaced by Tom Homan, who, whether you like him or loathe him, has served successive administrations, does have a reasonably good reputation within law enforcement. And I think that that is a signal that Trump is backpedaling here big time. And again, backpedaling for political and other reasons.
So what happens next then, do you think? As you say, the midterms are coming up. I think this will be one of those significant marks on Trump's second term that will be pivotal or things can be traced back to. So how do they manage this going forward? Because obviously there are those that love the idea of ICE going in and as we heard the press secretary describe, you know, paedophiles, rapists, gang members, etc., etc. So there are people that will want that work to continue. But obviously now it's very, very problematic for the administration. So what happens next? How do they spin this going forward?
Well, first of all, I mean, let's hope and pray that we don't have any more incidences like we've had thus far. Two Americans dead senselessly and needlessly. What I expect to happen is that ICE will take a much lower profile. I think that that will be the idea is that to get ICE off the TV screens and news programs every single day where they are the lead item because it is not doing the president or the Republicans any good. And perhaps under Homan, perhaps they might return to that original remit where it is actually a narrow focus on people who don't have the right to remain, people who have committed, in many instances, appalling crime. If they can rededicate to that remit, then perhaps they can claw back some of the political support that they've lost. But make no mistake, I think significant damage has been done here. And again, we spoke before, Greg, about the constituency that one of the constituencies that arguably swung it for Donald Trump last time is Latinos, the fastest growing group of, you know, Americans. He has taken very real hits with them out of the ICE instances. And that, I think, is not going to help Republicans seeking election in the midterms.
And just finally, obviously, America's hosting the World Cup and there are people claiming to cancel tickets. Whether they do or not, I don't know. But people scrubbing their social media and what have you. If they decide to do that, that's up to them. But I mean, wouldn't be a massive fan of that. But anyway, but also too, in just general conversation, Larry, I'm rambling a bit. People seem less inclined to want to go to the United States. And then we hear reports from the United States of some of the big tourist hotspots not being as busy as they once were. Is that a big issue? And can the United States rehabilitate itself to the point whereby it becomes that dream to go there at least once?
Yeah, a couple of things. You know, we've definitely seen some hits. You know, anecdotal evidence suggests very strongly that arrival lounges in airports, especially in places like New York and in Boston, are operating a fraction of the capacity that they used to, that there's just not as many people going there. To me, that's quite sad because despite everything we've seen, I think America remains a great country and there's an awful lot of Americans, it needs to be said, who are appalled by what they see, who are appalled by what's going on, for whom this isn't America. So it is worrying, but can America regain its stature? Look, America's seen low points in the past before. I have to be optimistic that better days are ahead, but certainly in my lifetime, Greg, we are really in uncharted waters with the depth of ill feeling from the Western world in the United States.
Okay. Listen, Larry, thank you very much for your time as always. Larry Donnelly, Boston attorney, University of Galway law lecturer and political columnist. On the issue of pharmacies, Greg, if there is no automatic cross-communication between pharmacists and the GP, this could be disastrous and have disastrous consequences. If a doctor prescribed medication that was not compatible with a medication previously given by pharmacists, we can't presume that the patient will disclose all this information. It's interesting you picked up on that, because that was a concern I would have as well. We don't always say exactly what we're supposed to say in that situation. So if there's no automatic sharing of information, I do believe it could be problematic. That being said, perhaps they've taken that into account, and for the 8 conditions that pharmacists can prescribe, maybe there is a low risk of what you talk of there. On the issue of abuse of shop workers, I see a lot of it, mostly because they think retail workers are below them. Yeah, that, I think that's part of it, to be honest. Another, as a shop worker, it's amazing how much bad manners we witness. My main issue is people on the phone at the checkout while ignoring me, and I just have to wait till they're finished their conversation. I think, too, it depends on where you are as well, too. Whether you're in Letterkenny, whether you're in Donegal Town, whether you are in Glenties, you know, the urban, rural sort of mix up. You know, I think a shop whereby there isn't a massive turnover on a daily basis of customers, maybe customers wouldn't have the neck to be abusive or insulting. I don't know. I'm just guessing. Packing their shopping really annoys me. They stand back and expect the till assistant to do it for them. That's more of an annoyance, I think, than something that's going to completely ruin your day. Another caller says abuse happens a lot when they're making complaint on the phone. Most things said there would not be said in person. I can imagine. I can imagine. On councillors voting for the local authority to come off the X platform, good on DCC. Starve the beast. Everyone with common sense should drop the platform. Another, Greg, you act like Twitter has more Irish users than any other social media. This is false. Twitter has never been a large platform compared to the actual giants. The reason Elon was able to buy it is because it was hemorrhaging money in the first place. This hasn't changed. It's why we had to rebuy it again with XAI, or he had to buy it again. I'm not overstating its importance, but people use different social media platforms in different ways. Instagram, more picture-focused, Facebook, it has its own sort of way people use it. Next is kind of information and news, and a way most organisations around the world communicate with people. That's just a fact. It's not an opinion. It's literally quite a fact. Governments, etc., etc. It's not just me saying it. I don't think it's a huge hit. I don't think the X usage in Donegal is massive either. So I see both sides. I really do.
The Community Garda information slot is brought to you by Sheridan Security Systems, monitoring homes and businesses in the Northwest for intruder, fire, panic and medical signals. Call Sheridan Security on 91-26025.
And you're welcome to Community Garda information for this Tuesday, the 27th of January, 2026. Our guest today is Garda Sean Sweeney from Buncrana Garda Station. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Greg.
Thank you so much for calling down and helping us with the item. And we'll start with appeals, if that's okay. And a burglary in the south of the county first.
Yeah, it's occurred at a vacant property in the area of Ballylochan, Brooklis, between Friday the 9th of January and Wednesday the 21st. The property is believed to have been entered via a previously smashed window. The furniture is moved around inside. The electric heating was turned up, and nothing is believed to be stolen, and there's no damage caused. So our appeal is anybody observed any type of suspicious activity, people or vehicles in the area between those dates, or if you have relevant information, can you contact Ballyshannon 071-985-8530.
Your colleagues in Ballyshannon also dealing with a criminal damage incident in Donegal Town.
Yes, occurred at the Mart car park in Donegal Town between 2 p.m. on Saturday the 24th January and 3:30 p.m. on Sunday the 25th. A vehicle broken down was left parked at the location. The damage was caused between those hours. So the front driver passenger side windows were broken, and the rear, as was the rear window. Damage is also caused to one of the lights. So if anybody's any relevant information, again, contact Ballyshannon on 98 58 530.
All right, that's broad daylight, and it's quite a popular area, so someone is bound to have seen something. Get in touch with Ballyshannon Gardaí. Dangerous driving incident in Killigordon next, Sean.
Yeah, this occurred at Carrickshandrum, Killigordon. This is the back road to the crossroads from Ballyfey. It's occurred on Friday, the 23rd of January at 11:15 p.m. A silver Volkswagen Golf GTI, partial registration of 08D, so they're driving at high speeds in the area, causing oncoming traffic to take evasive action. Was travelling towards the crossroads from Ballybofey at the time, so our appeal to anybody who's along that route in the crossroads Killigordon area with dashcam footage between 11 p.m. and 11:45 p.m. Please, if you have it, make it available to us, and you can contact Ballyshannon again, the number displayed.
Now, we are staying on the roads, and a road traffic collision in Culdaff being investigated.
Yeah, it's occurred on a R238 in Culdaff. This is between Culdaff and Mallon near Temple Mile Crossroads. This is in the early hours of Sunday, the 25th of January, at approximately 12:40 a.m. The driver and one of the four passengers who was on board sustained injuries, which weren't threatening, to receive medical treatment. Our appeal, again, is for dash cam footage around that time. Make it available to Gardaí, or if you've witnessed a collision, contact Buncrana on 93205 40.
And a road traffic collision in Lifford being investigated.
Yeah, appealing to anybody who travelled on the N14 between Lifford and Letterkenny with dashcam on the morning of Saturday, the 24th of January, between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. to contact them on 9167100. Single vehicle road traffic collision occurred at Mullingong, Lifford, at approximately 6:40 a.m. that morning. The driver was travelling towards Letterkenny at the time of collision. She reported that a silver car was travelling in the opposite direction from Letterkenny towards Lifford. It overtook a lorry in a bend. She was forced to take avoiding actions by veering towards a grass verge to avoid a head-on collision. She wasn't injured, but her car was damaged. The other driver didn't remain at the scene. So, look, we're appealing the driver of that silver car. Could you please come forward and get in touch with Gardaí and Letterkenny? Also, the driver of the lorry who was there at the time, could you please make contact with us?
All right, OK. Now, let's get some information on some searches that have been conducted over the course of the last week in East Donegal.
Yeah, so the Donegal Divisional Drugs Unit executed a number of search warrants at various locations in East Donegal. This was on Thursday, January 22nd, as part of Operation Tara. During the course of searches, they recovered controlled drugs, namely cannabis, cocaine, tablets, cash, and a number of firearms. The drugs and firearms be sent for analysis now, and files be submitted to the DPP, and investigations are ongoing.
Right, now, just a reminder that Gardaí continue to police the roads, and a reminder of that, recent instances, recent arrests.
Yeah, so the Letterkenny Roads Policing conducted a speed check on the N56, the four lane in Letterkenny, on Sunday, January 25th. So a car was detected travelling at 135 kilometres per hour. The driver was then arrested, and his charges appeared before court. I just urge motorists to remember the speed limit in that area is 60 kilometres per hour. That's between the Dry Arch and the Polestar roundabout.
Yeah, and also a reminder that there is a point at which these offences become arrestable as well, too,
exactly,
which
yeah.
has significant consequences.
It does.
Right, that's an incredible speed, 135 kilometres on that stretch. Incredibly dangerous. Right, now, an update on some arrests that have been made.
Yeah, so this is on Monday night, the 26th. Again, the road policing units in Letterkenny detected a car travelling at 179 kilometres on the dual carriageway. So the driver was arrested and charged to court. The car was then seized under Section 109, and under this legislation, to get the car back, you have to apply to the district court judge. So, you know, that's just incredible speeds here. Like, so.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't see that second incident. 179 kilometres per hour on the dual carriageway in Letterkenny. Again, another arrest. Car seized and an appearance in court on the way. Yep, that's, we're going in the wrong direction, aren't we?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Right, so speed kills, folks. Please, please, please slow down. Right, sorry, on to the theft instances and some arrests that have been made too, or an arrest. You have the details, Sean.
Yeah, so this afternoon of Sunday, the 25th of January, Gardaí alerted to theft occurred at a business premises in the main street in Bundoran. Family had their backpack containing children's electronics and their woman's purse stolen from them. So Gardaí arrived and viewed CCTV footage. They then arrested the woman and connected with an incident a short time later, and they managed to retrieve the backpack and the contents and return to the family.
Right, okay. Now, is it the second incident, this on Monday the 26th?
Yeah.
What happened there?
So it was Monday morning.
That's yesterday, actually.
Yeah. So Gardaí alerted to the fact that two men were attempting to steal money from a charity box at the chapel in Buncrana. So the Gardaí attended the scene and viewed the CCTV footage. So after an extensive search was conducted by local units, they then located the two men in question. They were arrested a short time later in Buncrana in connection with the incident. So they were detained, questioned and charged, appeared before the court, and a sum of money was recovered.
Excellent work. Great work. Right, bogus callers. Just a further reminder, they're very active as always. So
yeah, they're like all year round. So like, this is in relation to possible bogus caller in the New Mills area of Letterkenny. This is yesterday morning, Monday 26th. A man and a woman travelling in a blue Volkswagen van, calling the houses, offering power washing services. So bogus callers in general offer services like power washing, painting, tarmacking, or they may be offering goods for sale, such as tools and generators. They prefer to target more vulnerable people or people living alone and advise people not to engage with them. So don't open your door to anybody you're not confident you know who they are. And if you have any doubts, contact Gardaí immediately, and we'd ask you if to retain as much information as possible, such as a description of the person, the registration of the vehicle and the direction of the travel. Any detail there helps us out. Ask to be vigilant, especially for your neighbours if you see anybody around.
This is your home, this is your property. If you feel intimidated, if you feel under pressure, you know, firstly, the chain's a fantastic way to engage with people without actually having to engage with them physically. But call the guards, that's what they're there for, and record any information that might be useful. If in doubt, keep them out. Now, God bless St. Bridget. She contributed so much, not least more recently. And I mean, with this, with no disrespect, a bank holiday in February. And of course, all bank holidays, all public holidays present the same challenges. And just a warning of a road safety operation.
Yeah. Just look, for all road users, be a driver, pedestrian, or cyclist, we ask you all, please be careful. There always, as such, every bank holiday, there's a road safety operation in place. So Gardaí be conducting high visibility patrols, checkpoints, mandatory intoxicant testing checkpoints and speed checks all across the Donegal division. So we're asking people, don't drive under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Slow down, wear your seatbelt and leave your mobile phone or have it in an appropriate place, handhold while you're driving. And please don't take any unnecessary risks. If you need to contact us over the weekend, there's four stations 24/7 with Letterkenny, Buncrana, Milford and Ballyshannon, or call 999 or 112 if you need us.
In an emergency, okay. Listen, thanks as always, Garda Sean Swinney. I really do appreciate your time. That was Community Garda information for this Tuesday, the 27th of January. It's back live for you just after the 10 o'clock news next Tuesday. We're joined on the programme now by the Bishop of the Diocese, Ruffo, Bishop Niall Cole. Good morning to you, Bishop. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
How does the title sound? I know it's not about a title, right? But, you know, it must feel a little surreal still, does it?
It certainly does. And at the rehearsal on Friday night, I was sort of very emotional because that's the cathedral where St. Eunice, where I was ordained to the priesthood in 1988. And therefore, it has always been a very special place for me. And I think of my days of when I was studying for the priesthood, coming into the cathedral, and I never would have thought that I would become Bishop of Ruffo. And so I'm very humbled and very honoured. And of course, I've moved up from Kilkenny, from being Bishop of Austria. I'm not new to the episcopacy, as they say, but it's a great privilege now to be called to be Bishop of my home diocese.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. There is a particular significance, I suppose, to be home.
Yes, I think we Irish people have a particular attachment to place, to home, more than I've found in many other nationalities. So, and to be from Donegal is so particular in terms of Ireland and the Irish experience. We're not Northern Ireland, and in a way, we're not the Republic of Ireland. No, we're not the South of Ireland. We're quite different, and we're distinctive, and we have to stand up for ourselves. And I've learned that in the sense of being 3 years bishop in Kilkenny in Austria, That's very much Ireland, part of the old Peel, and they don't have to fight the way Donegal people do. You know, they have good roads, for example. they have very good services. The pharmaceutical industry, the financial services, computers, in a way, they're developed in a way that I would love to see that happening in Donegal. But of course, we'll need roads for that to happen. Yes. And so I'm praying that we Donegal people have a strong, distinctive identity. And
it's funny to people from down the country, if I could put it like that. I think sometimes they think that maybe we campaign and moan, if I could phrase it like that, for the fun of it. And maybe they don't appreciate some of the infrastructure and the employment and their proximity to Dublin that they have, you know, compared to us.
Greg, I think you're flattering yourself.
Right.
The people down there, it's that they don't give Donegal a second thought. And I mean that, like, I love them, many of them are my friends, but in a sense it's so far away. And when most people say, you know, we're growing up, the troubles were on in the north, so they regarded, you know, the six counties, Ulster, as very dangerous, and they weren't brought to it. They didn't visit. And so I say that the one time a lot of people in the south did visit Ireland was at the end of the pandemic. Do you remember that summer? And
the staycation.
The staycation. And the Atlantic drive.
Atlantic way.
So many people have told me how that was their first time in Donegal and how beautiful the county is and how sorry they were for me that I was out. Did I miss the mountains and the hills and the beaches? And I said I certainly did. But Kilkenny and Laois and that part of the country have their own attractions as well.
You mentioned your ordination in 1988. What age were you when you were drawn to the church, if that's what it felt like, or that you were considering a life in the priesthood?
I went immediately after the leaving cert. Mm. And just remember the day of Irish in the leaving cert. I went for an interview to the bishop's house and climbed up those big steps, and old Bishop McFeely, it was his last year, he interviewed me and a few other students. That was way back in 1981. So then I started in Maynooth in 1981, and there was a few other.
So you actually, that conversation, that conversation obviously aligned to where you were at. So you enrolled in Maynooth in the same year that you met the bishop.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. The old light word was I was nominated in September then as a student.
Yes.
For the Diocese of Raphoe. But you know, I never thought at that time. When I went, I said I'd go and test my vocation, to use that language.
I can understand that, though.
But in a way, I don't think I thought I would ever end up staying. Mm. I felt I had to give it a shot, as they would
say. Was there a spiritual draw, though, at that age?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And
so you felt a pull?
Yeah. In fact, yes, I felt this is what God was asking of me. And in a sense, through ups and downs, I've never thought differently ever since.
And did you articulate that to people around you, or is that something just with the passing of time it's easier for you to reflect on? I'm just curious as to how those conversations
That's a great question, because I don't think I would have been able to articulate that. It was just an intuition, a feeling.
Yeah.
I would say now, in a sense, it's the prompting of the Holy Spirit at work.
Mm. I think that shows a great maturity, even at a young age, doesn't it? To sort of know yourself, that you don't, you know what I mean, that you can keep that within you, but also as an older person to be able to reflect and know it was there.
Yes, later on. Mm. In fact, that was part of my homily on Sunday, because the gospel was the call of the fishermen, and Jesus' words were to them, were follow me. He didn't say understand me. He didn't say these are my what I'm going to teach. And you know, people, in a sense, those fishermen, those first disciples, they followed, and I think it's only later that they understood.
Mm.
And I don't think we ever fully understand this side of the grave, but but you have to be open. And I often think that as a couples getting married, like, what is more beautiful than a married couple who love each other through thick and thin, who are there for each other? But it's an act of trust, isn't it?
Yeah.
To, you know, to commit your life to another person. And so it's not just, what I mean by that, it's not just priests who have to discern and make commitments. We all do. And I'm just giving you that one example.
No, I understand, yeah.
Of marriage.
So people can tap into that, into themselves, to understand what you're talking of in your experience.
Because we all mature and develop and change. And I suppose a good marriage is about a constant renegotiation, isn't it?
Mm.
As people change, we have to, in a sense, continually negotiate or realign.
You're like a well-thrown boomerang because you always come back.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
1991 was a return to St. Eunan's College as a teacher.
As teacher and chaplain.
Yeah.
And that was me returning to the school that I had left in 1981. So it's 1989 I arrived back there.
Yeah. Was it?
Okay. It was 1989 to 1991.
Until 91, of course.
91,
okay.
Yeah.
So it was something of a first full circle for you.
Yes.
And you continued studies.
Yes.
That was a choice.
Well, actually, no. Bishop Hegarty sent me first for teacher training, and then I returned to Rome and I did further studies, a doctorate in theology. That was from 1992 to 1995. And then I taught in a seminary for a few years in Carlow. And then I returned to Boomerang, as you say, to Donegal. I was curate in Dunloe and teaching and chaplain in the Rosses Community School. And that was a great time for me as well. And then after that, because I had an academic background and a teaching background, I was suitable for a job in St. Mary's University College in Belfast, which is a college of Queen's University. So I was there for about 18, 19 years and teaching teachers, primary and secondary. And so.
And have you seen your movement as a gift, if you know what I mean, or has been a series of emotional pulls? Now, I know there's a sort of an acceptance that really you can never become too attached because you never know at what point right you might have to leave. So has that been a gift, the times that you spent in certain places and then moved to others? Or has it been a series of breakups?
Well, moving is always difficult. To uproot is always difficult. But in a sense, the life of the priest is like that. You know, that you're sent to where the need is. And so that's what happened in my life. You know, I had both the pastoral background and the teaching background. So tasks came my way, and they found it hard to find people to teach theology. Then by 2020, Bishop McGuckin was sure that it was time for me to return.
Well, I would argue this is actually the peak of your career, your life so far, because you were blessed with Drumholm.
Yes, correct. Where you have roots. and I was there, you know, at the height of the pandemic.
Yeah.
The church was closed nearly all the time that I was there. But in a fabulous way, I got to know a lot of people very well, because lots of people came to the parochial house to meet me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were curious as to who this new priest was. And then as well, they were anxious, you know, the old and the sick were anxious that they would still be visited by the priest. So with the pandemic restrictions, I just couldn't go willy-nilly. So I said if people rang and wanted me to come to visit them, I would. So I did. And so I got... and. You know, remember back in the pandemic, there was less pressure, less rush. So I had the privilege of, you know, visiting lots of, you know, old people and throughout the parish of Drumholm and the time to talk.
Yeah.
And I look back on it now as a great privilege.
And then
I was moved then to Town of Willie. And again, it was quite, the pandemic restrictions, we were just beginning to emerge from them. It was a strange time, wasn't it?
It really was.
But there's a lot of good. in the time that we had time for things, time for family,
friends. We did, and I think we ended up with a better understanding of things as well. I think we got a better understanding of isolation, loneliness.
Yes.
You know, things that people endure all of the time and continue to do so. And I think actually we've forgotten some of the lessons learned, but we all got a sense of what rural isolation, for an example, can feel like.
Yes.
So do you aspire to be a bishop as a priest? Like, are you allowed ambition? Not you personally, but, you know, because obviously we've had to jump quite a far way forward, and we're almost right up to your appointment as Bishop of Ossory. You pronounce it differently. How do you pronounce it?
Ossory.
Ossory, okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
So we're almost getting to that point now. Does a call to be a bishop come out of the blue?
It does.
Yeah.
You don't canvass for it. It isn't advertised. But there's a process that is in place. You know, people are written to and asked to nominate candidates, and there's quite a close scrutiny.
Mm.
And your question, I don't think anyone would aspire to be a bishop. I don't mean that. That's not false humility. It's a difficult old job, and it brings a lot of responsibility.
Yes.
And the only way that one can exercise the office is that of, you know, the people and priests, in a sense, support you and pray for you. Yeah. And, you know, work with you. And because often you have to make decisions.
Well, the book also stops with you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not like in certain businesses, people can be quite clever at moving responsibilities around, if you know what I mean. But ultimately, the book stops with you.
Yes. And so that's very... So I have 3 years of experience of that now. And we're living in a changing church. You know, there are fewer priests. You know, there's decline in practice, and you know, there are difficult decisions probably that lie ahead. You know, and like I always say, about, you know, we have so many churches and chapels in Ireland because they go back to a time when people didn't drive, how to support that network of churches into the future
will be a challenge.
Will be
but
a challenge.
That being said, I mean, in Drumholme, you know, Lahibar Church used to be a regular Sunday Mass, and then obviously because of pressures and what have you, perhaps not as regular. And we'll see situations in Termin and Creasland. People would, you know, there's been some. It's understanding and how things are communicated. Do you think that's important? So if you do have tough decisions about how the church can function practically, do you think communication with the congregation is important?
Communication is essential. And in the life of the church today, there's a much greater emphasis on lay participation. You know, each parish having, you know, a parish finance committee, and then a parish pastoral council where issues are discussed. I think looking to the future, there will be far more lay ministry, lay responsibility.
Mm.
And but we have to work on that together.
So in terms of any decisions you might have to make, is that an ongoing process? How does that work? You know, if it means a priest covering a couple of parishes or whatever the ins and outs of it might be. Is that an ongoing work? Is that work you've begun already? Is that something we should anticipate?
Well, the diocese that I'm just leaving now, Ossory, is much shorter of priests than Raphoe.
Mm.
And they have quite an advanced project of building what they call pastoral areas.
Mm.
So that's where you put three parishes together. And may have one or two priests serving those. And so there are models out there. It's not a one-size-fits-all. We'll have to work on that. And I should say that the Diocese of Raphoe, relatively speaking, has younger priests, and we have 5 students for the priesthood.
Which is impressive.
So we're not in the same situation as, say, Ossory is. So pray that the Holy Spirit will send us vocations, and that the life of faith will be treasured in our communities and in our parishes as we look to the future.
If you had, if you were Jim McGuinness and you had a 3-year plan, okay, but in terms of, I'm on about now, not whatever decisions that you may have to make, but in terms of where you'd like to see the church and its place amongst the community and participation on it and in it, is there anything that you would like to do over the next number of years different?
You asked me earlier about my student days.
Yeah.
I remember in 1987, just the year before I was ordained to the priesthood, Cardinal O'Fee spoke at a synod in Rome called by Pope John Paul II. And in it, at it, he said on his feet, he coined a phrase. He says, you know, the task of the church today is to awaken the sleeping giant of the laity. So I think that image is wonderful, that the church is the people of God, mm-hmm. and trying to help people awaken to their faith, to the fact that they're loved by God and that they're called to love of God and neighbour. They're called to build the kingdom every day. And that's my priority,
yeah.
is to help awaken people to the meaning of their baptism. And when I was in Drumahome and in Town of Willie, I think the thing ministry I enjoyed most was baptism,
mm-hmm.
because at the actual liturgies, you had a chance, and in the preparation, to talk to the parents about the meaning of the faith.
Yeah.
And see, I think in Ireland in the past, faith was something tribal. It was handed on in a tribal way. Mm-hmm. It's like in Kilkenny with the hurling, you know, they're hugely into the black and amber. And they don't have to think about who am I going to support. They're born into it. And Donegal's just the same,
yes,
you know,
of course,
with,
yeah.
with our Gaelic football. But in a sense, that's what religious faith used to be like. You know, you were born into the Catholic tribe or the Presbyterian tribe or the Church of Ireland tribe or the Methodist tribe and whatever. And the transmission of faith was easy. Today, the transmission of faith is not easy because we live in a very, you know, very secular, materialistic world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that having, in a sense, experimented with that post-Christian world, that many people will say, listen, we want more for our children. Mm. We want more in terms of giving them a meaning and a purpose in life. We want them to teach them to pray so that they'll know that they're never alone, especially in the most difficult situations. So what I'm trying to say is, I think there's every chance that many people will make the choice of faith, but it'll not be in the tribal way of the past, but in the personal way that's suited to today.
Okay, and the challenge is reaching those people, and it sounds very much like a challenge you're up to.
Yes.
Bishop Niall Cole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
Greg. I wish we had more time, but the news is upon us, and we look forward to chatting to you again into the future.
Thank you so much.
Bishop Niall Cole, Bishop of the Diocese of Raphoe. That's where we leave it on the programme for this Tuesday. We're back tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.